Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. This episode is a recording of John Matthews' talk, Absalom Absalom, A Story of Stories. This was recorded at Bowdoin College on March 7th, 2015, as part of Winter Weekend 2015 with Faulkner's Absalom Absalom. Dr. Matthews is a professor of English at Boston University. His research concentrates on American literature, modernist studies, literary theory, and literature of the U.S. South, with special attention to William Faulkner.
Since this is Absalom Absalom, I thought that I would start and then go backwards. I was struck by a couple of moments of nervous laughter that occurred in Bill Farris's talk yesterday. At one point he remarked, "When you finish reading Absalom Absalom, you're not sure what you've read." And there was a titter of recognition. When I was teaching Absalom Absalom once in a graduate seminar, I was trying to explain how Faulkner once described his motivation in writing Absalom Absalom as simply trying to create enough suspense to propel the reader. And I said, all he said he wanted to do was to get the reader to turn the page. And one of my graduate students fired back without a pause, "Yes, but in which direction?" The other moment of anxious laughter occurred when Bill used the word tornado to describe this novel. And I was reminded of Faulkner's comment about writing novels. He said, "Writing a novel is like trying to build a hen house in a hurricane." A lot of that frenzy comes through in a novel like Absalom Absalom. For me, of course, what first struck me as an undergraduate reading Absalom Absalom as the first Faulkner novel I'd read was the remarkable language. I'm not a Southerner. I'd never been to the South. I knew virtually nothing about Faulkner's world. But when I began reading that mesmeric first page, which we talked about earlier this morning, I realized that there was a kind of style at work here, styles at work, that were indescribable. The stand-on-your-head kind of acrobatics, the limitless inventiveness of Faulkner's imagination, the urgency of stories that are told but which constantly confound themselves. And I'd never encountered anything like it. Cedric's word for it was breathless this morning, and that's certainly the case. The torrent of language on the page in Faulkner's prose contrasts so remarkably with the taciturn person, a man who can sit in a boat for hours and not say anything to the other greatest living writer who's just down ship a little. Faulkner, as you know, spent some time in Hollywood in the 1930s and into the early 1940s. And one of his important credits for a film script was to have and have not, the Hemingway novel that he actually adapted. He was one of the script writers. Not everything that Faulkner wrote survived into the filming. And at one point, Humphrey Bogart was given a script for a scene. He looked at 6 solid pages of prose. And he said, "I'm supposed to say all that?" I'm thinking that one reason Faulkner might have gotten a D in his English course was because somewhere out there, there's the granddaughter of a teaching assistant who's still trying to get to the end of his final exam. My goal in what I say about the novel is to simplify it, and I don't imagine I'll hear any objections to that. Now I'm going to go back, though, and thank Charles and the other members of the staff and administration of the Maine Humanities Council for inviting me to this weekend, which is truly astonishing and wonderful. Cedric and I were talking about this last night. The idea that 200 people voted voluntarily. That's right. And then insisted on paying for 36 hours of outraged recapitulation. So I'm very happy to be here. Of course, I'm from Boston, so I'm happy to be anywhere. Very few people come to Maine for the climate in the winter. Storm after storm over the last few weeks, shoveling every morning. I've thought a lot about Wash Jones's comment. They might have killed us, but they ain't whipped us yet. But I also began thinking about Quentin Cunston coming north and what that means. The snow and the chill in his Harvard dorm room, sharing with a Canadian. The climate that's cool, the distance from his own place, versus the fervid, overheated South that Quentin comes from. In The Sound and the Fury, in his mind, he keeps going back and forth, Mississippi, Massachusetts. He notices the absence of lushness and of the greenery. He has to experience racial customs that are completely new to him. He has to experience the new sense of being shamed, of being himself a minority, an exotic, ostracized at Harvard, even a comic figure. You remember that in The Sound and the Fury, there's a couple from Kentucky, a young man and his mother, who seem destined never to be parted, who swirl through the portion of the novel devoted to Quentin's experience in The Sound and the Fury. In Absalom, we have Quentin and Shreve chattering in their dorm room through the night, cold as an icebox. But this is also a way, I think, for Shreve to chill a Southerner's hot blood. Remember that we're told that Shreve performs deep breathing exercises every night, and with the windows open. You can imagine him trying to provide a space in which Quentin can calm down, can remove himself, can detach, can ventilate from the passion with which he seems to want to defend his sister's honor, to proclaim his love for her, even, as we know, to die by his own hand. The South, in this stereotype, is associated with heat. It's a sensation that's both literally true of the South as well as symbolically true. It's a place where we learn in Dry September there's a touch that has to do with the extreme heat that symbolizes relations between the races, the hostility that comes from close proximity and suppressed violence. There's also the heat that's associated with the conditions of plantation labor on crops that require warm climates, the touchiness that goes along with fear, rage, doubt. In the 19th century, slavery was understood metaphorically as a slumbering volcano. It's an image that actually comes up in Absalom, Absalom, something that's ready to spout hot lava and violence. So the claustrophobic heat that begins the novel in Mississippi, in Rose's room, described as dim, hot, airless, is the sort of space that needs to be counterpositioned when, in the middle of the novel, Quentin comes to Harvard and begins to tell the story to an outsider under quite different circumstances. At one point, Quentin realizes that if I had been there, I could not have seen it this plain. And that has something to do with the capacity to remove himself from the conditions under which he originates his relation to the South. I want to thank the fellow panelists once to come, ones who've already spoken, for the rich contextualization that's already been provided and that, of course, will be provided for Absalom, Absalom. To a certain extent, Faulkner, as a Southern writer, as he was taken for a while, involved seeing him as as someone who was lamenting the decline of an aristocratic gentry, the sort of family that he came from. And that was particularly true of the Faulkner that had written early novels like Sanctuary and The Sound and the Fury at the very end of the 1920s. There was a way in which a certain class associated with civilized leisure and lettered existence were beginning to feel that they had been permanently displaced. There was the sense of the destruction of a racial paternalism that had produced hierarchy, place, permanence for a certain class of privileged white people. There was a famous conference that took place that eventuated, I know you've heard of this, a collection of essays by important Southern agrarians called I'll Take My Stand, which appeared in 1930. Even while it acknowledged the wrongness of slavery, it also presented a case for the importance of the regard for the land that the South was associated with its regard for place in a wider sense of the word, for a Jeffersonian agrarian ideal, and in the 1920s and 30s also for a view of life that was not associated with, which was the opposite of the North, which was associated with mercantilism and materialism. And these things, of course, we can see show up in Faulkner's writing even later, not just in the way in which he describes Sutphen as somebody who is interested in getting wealthy. Shreve keeps pointing out he got richer and richer, but also in the satire of the Snopeses, which Faulkner first began to think about in the mid-1920s in a manuscript that he called Father Abraham, the beginning of a new race he was beginning to think about in Yoknapatawpha, his imaginary county, and that would later be satirized in the whole phenomenon of Snopesism, which carried through into his writings of the 1940s and early 1950s. So the South was being positioned stereotypically, or at least by way of association, as a life that was the antithesis of the North. This is the way the South wished, some members of the South wished to imagine it. Of course, this was as much a caricature of the North as it was of the South. And the nation's view of the South also bore marks of stereotypical character as well. You think about the way in which the nation associated the South with a Gothic house of horrors, the cruelties of slavery for their own sake, the physical, mental, and emotional cruelty that went along with that system, with lynching as its successor, the unfeeling division of families and sexual predation in slavery, a culture of personal violence, open racism, widespread religiosity accompanied by manifest hypocrisy. We heard about Harriet Beecher Stowe's intervention, of course, in slavery, but one of the things that, as you know, she was most interested in defending was the integrity of Christianity, which she felt was being polluted by its misapplication to justifications for slavery. The South and the rest of the nation was associated with incest, miscegenation, necrophilia, the morbid love for a dead world, a certain kind of licentiousness and indulgence of passions. This is a tradition that runs back to Poe. It extends through a contemporary of Faulkner's like Erskine Caldwell. All of this a kind of projection by the North of what had been intrinsic to national prosperity, which was the South's plantation system. That is, the linkage between North and South was critical to national prosperity, and the disavowal of what took place in the South was part of a cultural imaginary, part of the way in which the nation needed to think of the South as other, as different, as something that could be disavowed. So I think that when Quentin is thinking Mississippi, Massachusetts, he's also thinking about an interesting historical link. He's thinking, you know, about the fact that he may not be thinking about it consciously, but he's capturing the way in which Massachusetts was also dependent upon Mississippi, that the cotton that was grown there also went to the mills of Lowell and were processed there. So there's a kind of historical undergirding to the association of these places as well, an economic one. In much of his fiction, Faulkner confronts these counter-projections of regional identity. In A Rose for Emily, for example, he out-Gothics the Southern Gothic. We find a moldering, hidden corpse, evidence of necrophilia, the grotesque details of poisoning by rat poison and rotting by arsenic, a rotting corpse, the strand of gray hair on a dead beloved's pillow. I mean, this is enough to make even Poe sick. And we see this notion of the gothicized South in much of what Shreve brings to the story, at least initially. He says, Jesus, the South is fine, isn't it? It's better than the theater, isn't it? It's better than Ben-Hur, isn't it? No wonder you have to come away now and then, isn't it? And there's that sort of exoticization of the South. I also want to point out, since we'll be talking about style, that there's something of Shreve's mockery of Southern oratory in that sentence, because you'll notice that the last phrase is out of place. It's better than the theater, isn't it? It's better than Ben-Hur, isn't it? No wonder you have to come away now and then, isn't it? And if you think about all of those passages in which those who are telling stories get caught up in certain kinds of repetition, once there was, once there was, once there was, Rose's story goes. And I think that what you hear often in this echo chamber of the novel are individuals who are repeating other people's styles as well. So that in this case, in a mode that is mockery, but at other places trying to pick up on the need to repeat, but also to revise what comes before. So the Gothic is associated with a mentality of haunting by the past, with grotesque exaggeration, with the sense of entombment. We see that we are plunged into that Gothic South in the first page of Absalom, Absalom, where we're given the picture of Rosa as a crucified child, captured in this, entombed, in a room reminiscent of Miss Havisham and Great Expectations. And what I'd like to think about a little bit is the way in which the story of Absalom, Absalom is a collection of stories, is a community of stories in a way, an assemblage of stories, and that they come into play as they address a series of questions. So the stories rotate around a nucleus of questions. Why did Henry kill Charles and flee? What did Sutpen say to Henry to precipitate this murder eventually? What's the source of Sutpen's early wealth? Who lives in the house? Who's come back? Why did God let us lose the war? Why do you hate the South? There are answers, maybe too many. But for simplicity's sake, let me suggest that what organizes Rose's response to these questions is the answer that Sutpen is a demon. She calls him Beelzebub. There's the imagery of Faustus, of various kinds of demonization that go along with him, the imagery of demonization. For Mr. Cumson, the answer seems to be something like fate, a decline of Western civilization in which the decline of the South somehow fits. And for Quentin and Shreve, I think the answer has more to do with the history of the South, not understood in a small way, not understood just as the deep South of the United States, but a larger South, a new world colonial plantation South that was based on racialized chattel slavery and racism. That this is finally more than a regional crime, that it's a national crime, and it may be a hemispheric colonial crime as well. I'm thinking about the importance of the episode in Haiti and the way in which for so long that was an episode that was simply not recognized by readers in the United States, at least. But that links the whole project of Sutpen's design to a very much older historical process. So Rosa, who's responsible for chapter one in a more direct way, and somehow for chapter five, in my notes I put chapter five in quotation marks, because chapter 5 has a very unusual standing. It seems to be a discourse that Rosa is delivering to Quentin. He listens, but at the same time, it seems not to have any place or time of delivery, as if it somehow exists in Quentin's head at the same time as a kind of remembered act of narration. So these two sections, though, are Rosa's, and she summons Quentin to tell him a story with the idea of preparing him to act, to resolve a mystery, perhaps to bring relief to her. What will the knowledge of this mystery give them? Who's living there? And the answer, of course, that she wants is, why did Charles Bond, my beloved, get murdered? She must suspect that Henry is there and can provide an answer. I want to try to briefly historicize Rose's situation. She's born in 1845. So she's the only narrator who actually has a direct link to the antebellum period. She's just young enough to have experienced the collapse and apparent discrediting of the plantation South before the Civil War. But she also has participated in the romance of the South. And you remember that not only does she subscribe to Sudpen's project up to a point, watches her own sister go off, but she also falls in love with the dream of that South. She falls in love with Charles Bond before she even sees him. And so there's a way in which she's prepared, a way in which she is already conditioned to accept this romance of the South, except something happens. Not only the Civil War, but the insult that she suffers in 1866 at its conclusion. What happens here is that Sudpen returns, and in some way that she never fully specifies, but which Shreve is only too eager to tell us, she learns something about the nature of the design. And the consequences that we're told on one page, on page 113, that she awakens as a self-mesmered dreamer. So what she has been disabused of is a certain deluded view of the Southern project. The third moment that we can think about in her career is the moment that she speaks after suffering this 43 years of insult in 1909. And there she re-enters life only to witness the end of a phase of her personal as well as regional history. What's happening, of course, in 1909 is that veterans of the Civil War are beginning to die. There's a sense that the nation has reunified. We, in 1912, elected the first Southern president since the Civil War in Woodrow Wilson. In 1898, the Spanish-American War was the first war in which Southerners were allowed to bear arms again. Mark Twain dies in 1910. In 1905, Thomas Dixon is publishing his virulently racist novels that celebrate reunion, national reunion, around the idea of whiteness, empire of whiteness. And in 1915, D.W. Griffith releases The Birth of a Nation, which is based on two of Dixon's novels and which reinterprets the Civil War, or at least popularizes an interpretation of the Civil War that is much kinder to the South, which downplays slavery and presents much more the legacy and the future of white solidarity. So it's out of that moment that Rosa emerges. Here's what she could have been. She could have been a partisan of the South's resurrection. There were plenty of, particularly women, who devoted themselves to what became known as the Lost Cause at the end of the 19th century. These were women who began to celebrate, to memorialize the heroic valor of the Southern combatants in the war. So they were responsible for forming the Daughters of the Confederacy. They were responsible for erecting monuments in towns. They were responsible for bringing Jefferson Davis back for tours. They were also responsible for helping to establish what we nationally now celebrated as Memorial Day, but which began as the celebration of Jefferson Davis's birthday on June the 3rd. It turns out, if you remember anything, if you've read The Sound and the Fury, you know that Quentin is meditating his suicide on June the 2nd. And when he's in Cambridge, he's asked, when he gets dressed for this occasion, he's asked what he's dressed so formally for by a jeweler. And he says, just a private celebration. It's a birthday. So there's this moment where the exile is still performing these rituals in his mind, but realizing how completely obsolete, how dead they are. But this is not what Rosa does. Even though during the war, you remember that she's writing odes to the Confederate soldiers and hiding them away. The reason that she does not become, it seems to me, such a figure is because she has been traumatized by her recognition that the design of the South cannot sustain that kind of reverential historical treatment, that kind of attitude. Among the many things that she sees is that the design was the institutionalization of a broad-based, various expressed form of brutalization. Many populations were brutalized as a result of the plantation scheme. So if we could, I'd like to take a look at page 134. I'm going to activate you again in the same way that Cedric did, but maybe in a slightly different way, for different reasons. I'm wondering first if anybody would be willing to read as much of this passage that begins at the middle of the page in Rosa's voice, as best you can, so that we can get a sense of the rage in her discourse. This is on page 134 in her attitude towards Sutpen. Is there anybody who's willing to start? Yes, mad, yet not so mad. She's thinking about Sutpen, and she's thinking about what he's done to her and trying to reason out the consequences on her.
Yes, mad, yet not so mad, because there is a practicality to viciousness. The thief, the liar, the murderer even, has faster rules than virtue ever has. Why not madness, too? If he was mad, it was only his compelling dream which was insane, and not his methods. It was no madman who bargained and cajoled hard manual labor out of men like Jones. It was no madman who kept clear of the sheets and hoods and night-galloping horses with which the canker separation of defeat, men who were once his acquaintances, even if not his friends, discharged the canker separation of defeat. It was no madman's plan or tactics which granted him gain at the lowest possible price, the sole woman available to wive him. And by the one device which could have gained his point, not madman. No, since surely there was something in madness, even the demoniac, which Satan flees, aghast at his own handiwork, and which God looks on in pity, some spark, some crumb to leaven and redeem that articulated flesh, that speech, sight, hearing, taste, and being which we call human, man. But no matter. I will tell you what he did, and let you be the judge.
That's good, actually, because what she goes on to say is that, you know, there might be, this is a comment on the novel, too, there might be some things which three words are three too many to say and to account, but 3,000 words that many words too less, and this is one of them. So it can be told, but it can't be told. I'll let you be the judge, but don't try to. I'm in charge here. And this sense of kind of repeated, it was no madman, which you hear underneath, a great deal of self-persuasion and doubt. You know, this there was something mad about Sutpen, or there was something not mad about him, but about his dream, as opposed to his methods, which seem all too sane. So this is like a condensation of the way in which it seems to me that Rosa sees through the illusions of the South, sees through its consequences. I'm going to read a passage on page 47, and in this case, I'm going to ask you a question about what the syntax actually does. I mean, one of the things that we can talk about is the way in which Faulkner's language actually enacts certain ideas, And I thought we could zero in on some of these to show that. We've begun. If you look on page 47, Rosa is trying to describe one consequence of what we earlier called patriarchy. So one of the things, of course, that happens is that we see that women's lives are destroyed under this system of heavily patriarchalized society. And what Faulkner allows Rosa to do is to complain in many ways, to identify the many ways in which her life has been ruined, has in effect not taken place. When you think about that first page in her not husband, later on not language, there's a way in which her entire life is defined by its negation. So his language, and that structure is known as a privative. You know, it's a way to, as we talked about earlier, it's a way to describe something through its opposite. And what I'm suggesting here is that the lives of women in this world are described as not something else. So in this case, let's notice the way in which Faulkner applies this sense of linguistic, stylistic dexterity to a description of Rosa's life. So this is on page 47 at the beginning of chapter 3. A grim mausoleum air of Puritan righteousness and outraged female vindictiveness in which Miss Rosa's childhood, that aged and ancient and timeless absence of youth, which consisted of a Cassandra-like listening beyond closed doors, of lurking in dim halls filled with that Presbyterian effluvium of lugubrious and vindictive anticipation which she waited for the infancy and childhood with which nature had confounded and betrayed her to overtake the precocity of convinced disapprobation regarding any and everything which could penetrate the walls of that house through the agency of any man, particularly her father, which the aunt seems to have invested her with at birth along with the swaddling clothes, was past. So you need, you sort of need an oxygen mask and a thesaurus or a dictionary, and a mythology won't hurt. So her position really is as a child. She's a crucified child. She's a case of arrested development. You know, for 43 years nothing has happened, so she's frozen in time. And you would think that her, you would think that sensibility would come through in a language that was appropriate to it, but in fact her language has grown up. Well, she has not. Yeah, it's like you need to throw open a parenthesis as well as a window, right? And let the syntax breathe a little bit. I think that's right. It also means that her life is, in fact, parenthetical, right? It's parenthetical to the discourse. And I think that when you get to chapter 5, those italics are meant to do something. I once challenged students to do Faux Faulkner, because there's a Faux Faulkner contest every year, and we were doing The Sound and the Fury. And I'd forgotten that there was a creative writer in the group. So she gave me this thing, which was astonishing. But in one part of it, it's sort of a meta mockery of a parody of the Sound and the Fury. And at one point, one of the characters threatens another by saying, "If you don't shut up, those italics are going to start again." The ultimate threat. The other thing that I tried to emphasize more than I needed to, I'm sure, was the way in which that closing was passed. Sort of it drops in the action at the very end of the sentence. So, I mean, this is related to the earlier comment, but there's a way in which the syntax suspends time so that you're not sure that action will ever come. Like maybe he'll forget. And, you know, so that's also a deliberate effect, I think, of the syntax. And then when it hits, it's over, right? There's something abrupt and violent about was past, because it's like 43 years in the flash of an eye. That's the horror of it. Endless and also completely inconsequential. So let me just say, by way of summary of this stage of or this part of her narrative, that in her discourse, in these chapters that we see the viciousness of class. Think about the way in which she describes Wash Jones coming up to deliver the news that Charles Bond is dead. That brute of a brute, you know, brute The word itself appears probably 10 times in a single paragraph. I know a single paragraph could mean 20 or 30 pages, but still, it's an impressive amount. And so we have this viciousness of class distinction. You remember, she constantly says Sutpen was no gentleman. The brutalization of blacks. Just think about the scene in the barn where physically Sutpen has to master his slaves. The brutalization of the land. He tore a plantation, tore violently. That other voice comes in to correct and to insist on the violence. Faulkner once said, the theme of this novel is a man who outraged the land, and the land then turned and destroyed the man's family. Could we turn briefly to pages 111 and 112? I'm going to read this, but I'm going to ask you what you think the language is doing here, too. This is where, in fact, the scene of the barred entrance to the stairs that will lead to the chamber where Henry is. And Rosa is describing how Clytie tries to stop her. "Rosa," I cried, "to me, to my face?" Then she touched me, and then I did stop dead. Possibly even then my body did not stop, since I seemed to be aware of it thrusting blindly still against the solid yet imponderable weight. She, not owner, instrument, I still say that, of that will to bar me from the stairs. Possibly the sound of the other voice, the single words spoken from the stairhead above us, had already broken and parted us before it, my body, had even paused. I do not know. I know only that my entire being seemed to run at blind, full tilt into something monstrous and immobile, with a shocking impact too soon and too quick to be mere amazement and outrage at that black, arresting and untimorous hand on my white woman's flesh. Because there is something in the touch of flesh with flesh which abrogates, cuts sharp and straight across the devious, intricate channels of decorous ordering, which enemies as well as lovers know because it makes them both. Touch and touch of that which is the citadel of the central I am's private own. Not spirit soul. The licorice and ungirdled mind is anyone's to take in any darkened hallway of this earthly tenement. But let flesh touch with flesh and watch the fall of all the eggshell shibboleth of caste and color too. Yes, I stopped dead. No woman's hand, no Negro's hand, but bitted bridal curb to check and guide the furious and unbending will. I crying not to her, to it, speaking to it through the Negro, the woman, only because of the shock, which was not yet outrage, because it would be terror soon, expecting and receiving no answer, because we both knew it was not to her I spoke. Take your hand off me, nigger. What's happening there? For me, this is one of the most remarkable passages in all of this novel. The passage opens up under the possibility of recognizing that the touch of flesh on flesh can destroy the shibboleth, the secret word, the code word of the South, if you will, of caste and color. And then, at like some kind of reflex, the sentence closes back in on itself. So her outrage at the beginning that Clytie should have the temerity to touch her and call her by name, and the use of that word at the end suggests the kind of trap, this sense of the prison house of language. And this is a moment that also expands to think about the way in which the many victims of brutalization in this book identify their common situation without ever actually being able to confederate. Let me just say one more thing about the work of the language here. The sentence that comes at the middle of the passage is this sentence. But let flesh touch with flesh and watch the fall of all the eggshell shibboleth of caste and color too. There's so much acoustic effect in that. You know, there's so much assonance and alliteration, right? So the one more comment I'd want to make about the music of this is that it's in the body of the language that the artificial divisions between human bodies break down. This is a sentence in which actual discrimination starts to disappear. The words begin to bleed into each other. Watch the fall of all, the fall of all, the eggshell shibboleth of... You see what's happening? It's as if the words are, to my ear at any rate, it's as if the words are beginning to blur into each other, as if the powers of discrimination are breaking down. So that part of what's happening is that this moment, you know, that you describe, which is a psychological or cognitive moment, is also a stylistic moment. And this is how Faulkner's sentences work. In a way, you can hardly believe that word by word there's such design in his writing. Because there's just so much of it, right? But there is a kind of fury of concentration that I do think produces these kinds of effects, which are highly effective at the local level. Maybe we can pick this up in the conversation afterwards, but I know I want to stay on the clock, and I will move much more quickly through the other two kinds of stories, but I just will throw these out to you and then finish in a few minutes. One, if we think about Mr. Cumson, he's always been the most difficult for me. I think that the way to understand him is that he's a son of the South who comes of age. He's born, let's say, in 1865 or so. He comes of age, has children in the 1890s, and then realizes that his class and his way of life have come to an end. So he, in fact, is stranded. We know from The Sound and the Fury that he's an amateur classicist. He's a non-practicing lawyer. In effect, what he's doing is overseeing the demise of his world. And what I feel in his world is the narrative of a kind of decline of the West. His mood is nihilistic. His tone is cynical. You remember that he has those passages that we could look at some point, or you could turn to, in which he talks about the way in which you bring all the ingredients together and the story just doesn't add up. You think it's going to, and it just doesn't cohere. At another point, he talks about how the past was integer for integer more heroic and grand. He keeps trying to tell this story as if it were, you know, the house of Atreus, as if it were Agamemnon returning, as if it were the Orestean trilogy, as if it were the story of King David and his son Absalom, and Amnon, his other son, who rapes his daughter Tamar, and the revenge. But these stories are outsized for the puny world that he occupies, it seems to me. So that Sutpen already represents this sort of decline because of his tawdriness, because of his fundamental stupidity, because of the way in which he just follows a script without understanding. When Sutpen tells his story, we're told that it's as if he's telling the story about somebody else altogether. He's not even conscious enough to tell his own story. And so there's a way in which this decline, it seems to me, is the decline into a sense of futility is the way in which we can understand Mr. Cumson's narrative. Quentin and Treve, I think, confront something else. They get to the question of the foundational insult, the brutality at the heart of, ultimately, I think, New World design, at least the plantation, expeditionary, colonial, speculative venture that produced the so-called discovery and development of the New World. And what Quentin and Shreve do, as you remember, is they get all the way back to Sutpen and Haiti at the origin. And I want to turn to this passage on pages 201 and pages 201 and 2. Let's start at the very bottom of 201. Grandfather has told the story to Quentin, grandfather has received it from Sutpen himself during the interlude where they're trying to track down the architect from Martinique who decides it's better to be, it's better to head out. It's like no signposts for Martinique yet, but the very bottom of 201, this is the description of the Haiti that gets described eventually as the place where Sutpen starts, where high mortality was concomitant with the money, and the sheen on the dollars was not from gold, but from blood. A spot of earth which might have been created and set aside by heaven itself, Grandfather said, as a theater for violence and injustice and bloodshed and all the satanic lusts of human greed and cruelty. And farther on in that page, the description of the little lost island, which is how Haiti was described in the 19th and 20th centuries. So without elaborating on this, I think it's very important that the initial insult, if you will, that Quentin and Shreve make their way back to, the answer to the question, has to do with the insult of the colonial plantation society with its practices of racial chattel slavery. This is the, in a way, the foundational contradiction of the American project, that it's based not just on an exceptional flaw, on a mis-execution of the dream. You know, this is not, we see this in Gatsby as well, you know, just trying to get it right. Sutpen thinks to himself, I made a mistake somewhere. There's a mistake. I can just, you know, I can find it. If I can find it, I can. But the problem, of course, is that the dream itself, the design itself, is constitutionally, fundamentally, ineradicably contradictory. And that's why the novel seems unresolved, because that's a continuing contradiction. It's the irresolution that we suffer with right through to the present, that we uphold our republican virtues by their violation. I think the book gives us a metaphor for itself. And I'm going to end with this. If you look on page 210, I was thinking of Cedric's metaphor of the circles of voices as well. This is about 14 lines, just into the last paragraph on the page. Maybe happen is never once, but like ripples maybe on water after the pebble sinks, the ripples moving on, spreading, the pool attached by a narrow umbilical water cord to the next pool, which the first pool feeds, has fed, did feed. Let this second pool contain a different temperature of water, a different molecularity of having seen, felt, remembered, reflect in a different tone, the infinite unchanging sky. It doesn't matter. That pebble's watery echo, whose fall it did not even see, moves across its surface to, at the original ripple space, to the old, ineradicable rhythm, thinking, yes, we are both father, or maybe father and I are both Shreve. Maybe it took father and me to make Shreve, or Shreve and me both to make father, or maybe Thomas Sutpen to make all of us. This is a novel of stories told and heard, expressed to satisfy the teller's need, but also shaped to meet the listener's need. Ultimately, this great novel becomes an exploration of the mystery of literature itself, that meeting between the will of the author and the want of the auditor, as well as between the want of the author and the will of the auditor. It's the creation of an imaginative site where the two encounter each other and create meaning together, or what Faulkner calls at one climactic point in Absalom, Absalom, the marriage of speaking and hearing. Thank you.
Please, some questions.
So we have,
or comments.
And so I was curious, since Quentin is, I'm a psychiatrist, he's coming apart at the end of this book, and then I'm shocked to learn that he later commits suicide, apparently because of all the contradictions that we've been talking about. He's internalized this, he can't resolve it, so he just basically walks into the Charles River. How much of that reflects, you know, what was going on inside Faulkner himself? Because he's clearly of the South, and he adopts the Southern lifestyle, and yet, you know, this book particularly seems to take it completely apart for all of us and for all time.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot there. I think in the terms of the novel itself, well, first of all, I guess I was the one who violated the spoiler alert, if you hadn't read The Sound and the Fury, although this is in the air. We know in the second section of The Sound and the Fury that Quentin is on his way to commit suicide. It, this is referred to in the other sections. One of the oddities, of course, is in the way in which Faulkner stages this moment, is that it takes place after Absalom, Absalom, but appears before. So The Sound and the Fury was published in 1929. If readers had read The Sound and the Fury in 1929, when they picked up Absalom, Absalom in 1936, they knew they were hearing a dead man's voice. They also knew, and so the Quentin who's getting ready to go away to Harvard is also a ghost, and he is a ghost. So there is a way in which the discourse of Absalom, Absalom is posthumous. This is also true for the one short story that Quentin is the identified narrator for, That Evening Sun, because we know then that somehow Quentin has survived and is now telling a story about the modernized South in the mid-1920s. This is an earlier, maybe an earlier configuration, but it also makes you realize that Quentin was always a dead man talking. That there's a way in which from the very beginning, like Rosa, he understood that his life was over before it began, or at least that's how he interprets it. Here's how Mr. Cumson sends Quentin off to college. Quentin remembers at the beginning of his section in The Sound and the Fury what his father told him before he left, when he gave him his grandfather's watch. It was grandfather's, and when father gave it to me, he said, "I give you the mausoleum of all hope and desire. It's rather excruciatingly apt that you will use it to gain the reducto absurdum of all human experience, which can fit your individual needs no better than it fitted his or his father's. I give it to you not that you may remember time, but that you might forget it now and then for a moment and not spend all your breath trying to conquer it. Because no battle is ever won," he said. "They're not even fought. The field only reveals to man his own folly and despair. And victory is an illusion of philosophers and fools." That is not the ideal pep talk. As your kid heads off to... And so... So I think that the weight of the futility that the family feels is just, you know... Quentin feels himself to be this commonwealth of voices, this barracks. What's interesting to me about the dynamic of Absalom, Absalom is that people are trying to save his life. The one way to understand what's happening in Shreve's otherwise comic, merely mirthful sort of extraction of entertainment is that he's trying to keep Quentin alive by keeping him talking. He won't let him refuse the story. Shreve knows everything in here already, because we're told this is not for the first time. The minute that Quentin shows up at Harvard, he begins to have to tell what it's like to be a Southerner. Tell us what it's like. So it's not that Shreve needs information. It's that he's trying to rehearse a story, in effect to debrief, to ventilate, I think, in order to keep Quentin alive. The word Shreve in Elizabethan language, you know, means to confess. So there's a kind of drawing out that Shreve is trying to do, and he's trying to lighten the story. You know, it's a comic version, which means it doesn't matter that much. Mr. Cumson is doing the same thing. In this novel, he's trying to lighten the load. He's trying to say, incest, you know, it doesn't matter. The real perfect incest is when you identify with the brother-in-law. Let's keep Charles Bond in play here. You know, that is the perfect incest, because it's really between you and Charles. We were talking about this before the session this morning. All of the romantic energy is not, you know, among the men, is between themselves. And so, I mean, this is another issue that we might talk about, and it has to do with Quentin's own sexuality. But I think that, at least from the standpoint of his relationship to his Southern heritage, Mr. Cumson is trying to keep him alive by saying, you know, all these things you care about, incestuous desire for your sister, virginity, it's not even a state of nature. It doesn't exist until it's lost, right? That's what he says. So in all these ways, he's trying to apply his cynicism on behalf of a son he knows is ready to commit suicide. And when he tells that story of Judith going to Mrs. Cumson to deliver the letter purportedly written by Charles Bond. Mr. Cumson tells that part of the story. And what he says, if you go back and look at it, is Judith is mistaken by Mrs. Cumson. Mrs. Cumson thinks that Judith is going to commit suicide and she wants to bring this letter for safekeeping. And when Judith realizes it, she says, oh no. She says, women don't do that for love. I don't think anybody does that for love. That's Judith talking to Mrs. Cumson. That's Mr. Cumson talking to his son. People don't kill themselves for love. And so, like, in these ways, he's throwing these lifelines. And it makes Absalom a double novel. It's a novel about itself, but it's also a novel about, you know, the Sound of the Fury. So from that standpoint, it seems to me that the transactional psychoanalytic dimension is extremely important. You know, like, you, Shreve wants to be the analyst. He wants to be the dummy against which Quentin can produce a discourse that will make it all seem right. The other part of your question, and I apologize for a long answer, but it was it's a wonderful question. The other part of it is, what's Faulkner's relationship to this? And I mean, the shorthand answer for me is that Quentin was an alter ego who had to be exorcised. Quentin is also a budding writer. You know, the sensibility that you see in that second section of The Sound and the Fury, and also in some of the way in which he records the voices that he's heard. I mean, Faulkner, too, was a barracks of voices. He was a commonwealth of stories that had been transmitted to him. And they could have been stupefying, they could have been crushing, they could have been life-ending. And I think, you know, that in some way he had to exorcise this weight of being responsible for guilt, and in a way for the guilt and shame that descends on him. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the use of the italics? Yeah. Because I was totally dumbfounded by throughout that.
There's a funny story from The Sound and the Fury. So in The Sound and the Fury, if you can believe it or not, the use of italics is much more complicated. In the first section, which is Benji's section, and you may know that Benji, the narrator of the first like 60-page section of the novel, is he used to be called an idiot, and that's what the terminology is in the novel. But there's a way in which he's simple. He's a natural, so he's unable, a natural in the the old-fashioned technical sense of not being able to process. He's mentally limited, and so what he does is record the events that he remembers. And there are dozens of places where Faulkner changes from one time zone to another time zone. That's the way he was using italics in that section. So when he sent it to the editor changed it all. He put everything, you know, that was in the present in Roman font, and he put everything in the past in the italics. And he instantaneously got a letter back. He was a friend of Faulkner's. He got a letter back saying, look, he said, it's not just the past and the present. There are 10 different time zones, and I can name them. He did. He said, and don't make any more changes, bud. I know you mean well, but so do I. So there, it's clear that this is a very deliberate, this is a very deliberate thing. I think here it's actually simpler in the sense that usually what happens is that you move into a consciousness, that this is somehow a different discursive terrain, if you will. Right? It's not something somebody is saying to somebody else, but it's something that exists somewhere between what someone is hearing and what someone is saying. And maybe, I mean, part of the amazing thing about this book is that it is very much storytelling, as Bill was pointing us to, and as we have been talking about today, but it's also written. It's a novel. And so, you know, like, part of what you feel is the cohabitation of two ways of producing narrative. One, storytelling, which is communal, which involves presence, which, you know, has to do with the presentation of certain kinds of knowledge. And the novel, which is much more solitary, solipsistic. It allows for a different temporality, return, and so forth. And I think Faulkner is trying to mark that tension because of the move from a more traditional storytelling culture in the South to a world that's opened up by writing. And writing is very different. It can go anywhere. It can even get into the hands of people who've never heard about the South, like Shreve. or like us.
The other contemporary author who wrote in unbelievably long sentences with elaborate punctuation was Proust. Was there any connection, or it's just
There's a very deep connection. I could even tell you about some, you know, like scholarship that's been, but this idea of the recovery of time through style, the use of individual physical reminders of the past, certain kinds of fetishizations, the Madeleine, the way in which, particularly the sound and the, pardon?
The smell of the wisteria.
That's right. These triggers, they bring up whole complexes, not just of emotional association, but also of like family, of desire. Yeah. I think Joyce was probably the most important writer to Faulkner. He was reading Ulysses from the beginning, even when it was only being published in serial form in the magazines that he and Phil Stone were subscribing to. He claimed, as writers tend to do, that he didn't read Joyce until he had finished The Sound and the Fury. But this is demonstrably not true because of a particular act of misogynistic cruelty in which he, intellectual misogyny, in which he took the novel Ulysses on his honeymoon. But assigned it to his wife to read while he was working on the proofs of The Sound and the Fury. She also waited halfway into the Gulf of Mexico before she was retrieved, and that's actually true, but I don't necessarily attribute all of that to Joyce. But I think the idea of taking an imaginary locale, that is to translate Dublin into an imaginary Boston, is very important because it's a way, first of all, it's an urbanization of modern experience. There are things that happen, you know, in The Sound and the Fury and Absalom, Absalom, that have to do with being in a city, with bringing disparate people together. In The Sound and the Fury, Quentin's always on the streetcar. Well, that speeds up life. It gives you different sensations. I mean, George Simmel talked about the way in which the sensory apparatus is completely rewired as a result of modern life in an urban environment. So I think that that's important. It's a different way of conceptualizing narrative, too. Narrative is organized by terrain. You know, it's spatialized. You go from place to place as opposed to time. It's 24 hours. You know, and so there's a way in which this is also happening in Absalom, Absalom. Nobody really goes anywhere, you know. They just sit there and talk and talk and talk. But you go everywhere. So I think, I mean, there are many, many other things to say about Joyce, but I think those are some of the important ones, in addition to the sort of classic things about stream of consciousness and how to, you know.
Punctuation.
Okay. Yes, well, of course, because like in The Sound and the Fury, Faulkner draws in an eye for a billboard that says, keep your eye on Mottstown. So it's keep your eye on Mottstown with an eye drawn in. And in As I Lay Dying, you might know that he draws the shape of the coffin. So there is a way in which the sort of scriptural qualities, the pictographic qualities of language are something that modernists share too. Yeah, okay.
Another stylistic device that was a tripwire for me, you have to read this book slowly, were all the uses of the word not in front of verbs and adverbs and adjectives. And that just, I mean, here is a zillion words in this, and he surely could have found something other than a not just or not this or that. Why does he insult the reader, in effect, by using all those not words?
It sounds like there might be answers already brewing here. Well, I mean, I think part of it does have to do with the idea that life for some of these individuals has been negated. So not husband is a way of describing what it means to have been all but married, right? To have been married in mind but not. And to have been, and but also the not, the thrust of that negative is also part of the thrust of the insult, you know? You're my betrothed, in effect, is what Sutpen says. And then when he makes his awful proposal that they mate and see if it's a son, and then they'll get married, it turns out that she's not betrothed. So she's been negatived. And that's a word that's used in As I Lay Dying for what happens to people when they are part of an abstract calculus. And that is Sutpen's Sutpen's mentality. It's a ledger mentality. This, not that. This, not that. What do I do if I've been turned down by the butler at the door? I become not Pettibone. I become not black. I become not poor. I become not Appalachian. You know, like there's a way in which this harsh binary runs through all of the systems of the South that would get touched too. Black, not white. So, I mean, I think there are other things too, but the other way to think about this is that it's violence on language. There's a word for that too. There's a rhetorical form called catachresis, and it's the deliberate misuse of language. So maybe happen is never once. Do you remember that phrase from the passage that we read? Maybe happen is never once. Well, happen is a verb, right? You can't say happen as, you can say happenstance, you can say happening, but happen is a verb, but he's using it as a noun. So part of the torturedness of the language, part of the violence of the world, infuses the violence of the language, it seems to me. One more.
I want to go back to the italics for a minute, because it seemed to me as I was reading that what I was getting in the italics was belief, not fact. Now, I don't know if that's true. I'd have to go back all over again, but that was my sense, that I was getting italics, and it was kind of waving a hand at me and saying, this is what I'm thinking.
More speculative.
I'm creating
or imaginary.
Story.
Yeah. The only reason I hesitate, I mean, I think that that's worth exploring. The reason I hesitate is because I don't think anyone has ever located the one incontrovertible fact in absolute absence. Was it Bonn who was wounded? Well, it makes sense in some account. But it also makes sense that Henry was wounded. Was it Judith's daguerreotype in the locket? Or was it the octoroon mistress? Yes. You know, it depends on the story you're telling and for whom you're telling it. So I think that there's probably some winching up that's happening in those italicized passages. But I don't know whether it's as simple as truth and falsity. Yeah. I'm happy to stand here and talk. Thank you, Tom.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.